Back when I was a fugitive, part of the underground. Back before Dan took me under his wing. Dan said, "This is a sort of homecoming for George." "Yeah," George said. "Reminds me of the bad old days. Almost brings a fucking tear to my eye." Dan laughed, and the Aussie laughed with him. Poncho just stood there, feeling enormously grateful to them both.
End of Side 8.
Star Power Limited.
Dan had offered space in Astro Corporation's office complex for the headquarters of the fledgling Star Power Limited. Humphreys had countered with an offer of a suite in his own Humphreys Space Systems offices. Stavanger suggested a compromise, and Star Power's meager offices opened in the other tower on the Grand Plaza, where Cellini's governmental departments were housed. Yet Stavanger had not been invited to this working meeting. Dan sat on one side of the small conference table, Martin Humphreys on the other. The room's windowless walls were bare, the furniture strictly functional. "I hear you've been having some problems with hackers," Dan said. For just a flash of a second, Martin Humphreys looked startled. He quickly regained his composure. "Whoever told you that?" he asked calmly. Dan smiled knowingly. "Not much happens around here without the grapevine getting wind of it." Humphreys leaned back in his chair. Dan noticed that it was a personally fitted recliner, unlike the other chairs around the table, which were inexpensive padded plastic. "The leak's been fixed," Humphreys said. "No damage done." "That's good," said Dan. "Speaking of the grapevine," Humphreys said lightly, "I heard a funny one just this morning." "Oh?" "There's a story going around that you and a couple of your employees stole a doer from the catacombs last night."
"Really?
Sounds like something out of an old horror flick."
"Imagine that," Dan said.
"Curious.
Why would you do something like that?"
Trying to find a comfortable position on his chair, Dan replied, "Let's not spend the morning chasing rumors. We're here to set our budget requirements." Humphreys nodded. "I'll get one of my people to track it down." "Or one of my people," Dan grumbled to himself. "But it'll be okay as long as he can't find Poncho's sister. Only she and George and I know where we stashed her." He said to Humphreys, "Okay, you do that. Now, about the budget?" They spent the next hour going over every item in the budget that Humphreys' staff had prepared for Star Power Limited. Dan saw that there were no frills, no allocations for publicity or travel or anything except building the fusion drive, testing it enough to meet the IAA's requirements for human rating, and then flying it with a crew of 4 to the asteroid belt. "I've been thinking that it makes more sense to up the crew to 6, Dan said. Humphreys' brows rose. 6. "Why do we need 2 extra people? We've got 2 pilots, a propulsion engineer, and a geologist." "2 geologists would be better. Or a geologist and some other specialist, maybe a geochemist." "That makes 5, Humphreys said warily. "I want to keep an extra slot open. Design the mission for 6. As we get closer to the launch, we'll probably find out we need another hand." Suspicion showed clearly in Humphreys' face. "Adding 2 more people means extra supplies, extra mass." "We can accommodate it. The fusion system's got plenty of power." "Extra cost, too." "A slight increment," Dan said easily. "Down in the noise." Humphreys looked unconvinced, but instead of arguing, he asked, "Have you picked a specific asteroid yet?" Dan tapped at his handheld computer, and the wall screen that covered one entire side of the conference room displayed a chart of the belt. Thousands of thin ellipsoidal lines representing orbital paths filled the screen. "It looks like the scrawling that a bunch of kindergarten brats would make," Humphreys muttered. "Sort of," said Dan. "There's a lot of rocks moving around out there." He tapped at the handheld again, and the lines winked out, leaving the screen deep black with tiny pinpoints of lights glittering here and there. "This is what it really looks like," Dan said. "A whole lot of emptiness with a few pebbles floating around here and there." "Some of those pebbles are kilometers across," Humphrey said. "Yep," Dan replied. "The biggest one is Ceres, discovered by a priest on New Year's Day, 1801. "You've been doing your homework," Dan said. Humphrey smiled, pleased. "It's a little over 1,000 kilometers across. If that one ever hit the Earth, goodbye to everything, like the impact that wiped out the dinosaurs." "That's just what they need down there," Dan muttered. "An extinction-level impact." "Let's get back to work," Humphreys said crisply. "There's no big rock heading Earth's way." "None has been found," Dan corrected. "Yet." "You know," Humphreys said, musing, "if we were really smart, we'd run a demo flight to Mars and do a little prospecting on those two little moons. They're captured asteroids, after all. The IAA has ruled the whole Mars system off-limits for commercial development. That includes Deimos and Phobos." Hunching closer to the conference table, Humphrey said, "But we could just do it as a scientific mission. You know, send a couple of geologists to chip off some rock samples, analyze what they're really made of." "They already have pretty good data on that," Dan pointed out. "But it could show potential investors that the fusion drive works and there's plenty of natural resources in the asteroids." Frowning, Dan said, "Even if we could get the IAA to allow us to do it..." "I can," Humphrey said confidently. "Even so, people have been going to Mars for years now, decades. Investors won't be impressed by a Mars flight, even if our fusion buggy gets there over a weekend." Firmly, Dan said, "We've got to get to the belt. That's what will impress investors. Show them that the fusion drive changes the economic picture." "I suppose," Humphrey said reluctantly. "And we've got to lay our hands on a metallic asteroid, one of the nickel-iron type. That's where the heavy metals are, the stuff you can't get from the moon or even the NEAs." "Gold," Humphrey said, brightening. "Silver and platinum. Do you have any idea of what this is going to do to the precious metals market?" Dan blinked at him. "I'm trying to move the Earth's industrial base into space, and he's playing games with the prices for gold. We just don't think the same way. We don't have the same goals or the same values, even." Grinning slyly, Humphrey said, "We could get a lot of capital from people who'd be willing to pay us not to bring those metals to Earth." "Maybe," Dan admitted. "I know at least 3 heads of governments who would personally buy into Star Power just to keep us from dumping precious metals onto the market." "And I'll bet," Dan growled, "that those governments rule nations where the people are poor, starving, and sinking lower every year." Humphreys shrugged. "We're not going to solve all the world's problems, Dan. We ought to at least try." "That's the difference between us," Humphreys said, jabbing a finger in Dan's direction. "You want to be a savior. All I want is to make a little money." Dan looked at him for a long, silent moment. "He's right," Dan thought. "Once upon a time, all I was interested in was making money. And now I don't give a damn. Not anymore. None of it makes any sense to me. Since Jane died, God, I've turned into a do-gooder." Leaning forward again toward Dan, his expression suddenly intense, earnest, Humphrey said, "Listen to me, Dan. There's nothing wrong with wanting to make money. You can't save the world. Nobody can. The best thing we can do is to feather our own nests, and..." "I've got to try," Dan interrupted. "I can't sit here and just let them drown or starve or sink into another dark age." "Okay, okay." Humphreys raised both hands placatingly. "You go right ahead and beat your head against that wall if you want to.